show is on case 42 in the Mumonkan, in the Heikigan Roku. Case 42 is entitled Hokoji's Beautiful Snowflakes. Engo's introduction. He talks independently, acts independently, and trudges through the mire for the sake of others. He talks with others, acts with others. He stands alone, like silver mountains and iron cliffs. If you doubt and hesitate, you will be like a ghost haunting a skull. If you stop to think, you will fall into hell. Don't you see the bright sun shining in the sky and feel the cool breezes blowing across the face of the earth? Was any of the great ones of ancient times like this? See the following. Main subject. Hokoji was leaving Yakusan. Yakusan let 10 zenkaku, Zen students, escort him to the temple gate to bid him farewell. Koji pointed to the falling snowflakes and said, "Beautiful snowflakes, one by one, but they fall nowhere else." Then one of the zenkaku, named Zen Zenkaku, said, "Then where do they fall?" Koji gave him a slap. Zen said, "Koji, you shouldn't be so abrupt." Koji said, if you are like that and you call yourself a zenkaku, Emma will never let you go. The teacher will never let you graduate. Zen said, "What about yourself?" Koji gave him another slap and said, "You look, but you are like a blind man. You speak, but you are like a deaf mute." Secho adds this comment, "Why didn't you hit him with a snowball in place of your first question?" Secho's verse, "Hit him with a snowball! Hit him with a ball!" Even the best will fail to reply. Neither heaven nor earth knows what to do. Eyes and ears are blocked with snow, transcendent serenity and purity. Even the blue-eyed monk can't explain. Blue-eyed old monk. That would be Dharma, Dharuma, Bodhidharma. This is a very important koan, for many reasons. One way people think about Buddhism is that it is passive. And you could definitely draw that conclusion. So if you went to some retreats, people would be doing something all day long, you know. So you might go to one of these retreat centers, institute, and they might have a retreat on. Getting to know yourself better or learning to like yourself or something. And they would have guest speakers coming, and they would be people who do the circuit. You know, they give talks on liking yourself, how to like yourself. And there'd be a brochure and a picture of the speakers and a little blurb on them and the name of their book, you know. And so you could go to it would be like a seminar. And the person would be a psychologist or a social worker and would talk about how to like yourself a little better. And people might even take notes, you know. And then they might do workshopping, you know. And there's nothing wrong with this, by the way. I'm not belittling this at all. And then, you know, then you might do workshopping with role-playing where somebody puts you down and you have to think about how you respond and maybe go through different styles of response and try to relearn how you respond. I was involved in a day-long training for suicide prevention at Rutgers because we've had some problems with student suicides and they're trying to get faculty and staff to have the skills to deal with this problem and to see the warning signs, you know. So we had a seminar, and then we had workshops in the afternoon. And you know, you could go to a five-day retreat where these kinds of things went on every day, you know. And people would be very busy. They'd be going to this talk and that talk, and they'd be making notes, and at lunch they'd all get together and talk. And at the end of the whole thing, people might say, boy, this is really a whirlwind of activity. If you come to Sesshin, you know, it's, you know, 4:30, where are we? On the cushion. Nobody's moving, right? We do recite sutras, but then, you know, 6 o'clock, basically no moving till 7:30. We move to take a pee, you know, come back, no moving, breakfast, we move a little bit, back on the cushion, no moving. You know, so there's something also, well, there's something about what we're doing that seems very passive. And indeed, you know, actually part of Zen practice is, you could say, pacifying the mind. So, you know, when you're watching your breath, at first your mind is a nervous wreck, and you have lots of distractions, and it's your mind is sort of like wildly going this way and that. And you might also have a lot of emotional issues going on. So, you know, you're remembering something that happened to you, and it's causing anxiety or anger or fear, and you know, it's like a monkey, the monkey mind. And then we do something like breath perception meditation, which is a koan in itself, called Susoku-kan. That is a way of, partly a way of tranquilizing the mind, of making the mind calm and centered and slowing down, right? And becoming more passive. Okay. So you know, we don't move much. We aren't taking notes. We aren't going to seminars, and we start by making the mind calm and lowering the level of mental activity quite a bit. You know. So it would be easy to think that Zen is about being passive. And when we imagine a person who's a Zen person, say an enlightened person, we imagine the person, and even the sutras say this, you know, somebody who can walk down a busy street unaffected by his surroundings. So, you know, a calm in the midst of chaos, right? You know, and somebody's walking down the street and there's all this chaos, but this person has a smile on his face and or on her face, and is just moving through it all, untouched, unaffected. And again, this seems as there's a kind of passivity in this image, right? When you think about Buddha's teaching of wu wei, which means act but don't act, you know, act without purpose. And that seems kind of passive again, right? And finally, there's the Buddhist teaching of ahimsa, nonviolence. You know, the Buddha specifically left the world of political and social activity. You know, the Buddha left the palace, and he could have been a wheel-turning monarch, as it says. He could have been a historically important monarch in Indian history, you know. And instead, he disobeyed his father, and he became a world renouncer. He left his home. He abandoned his possessions. He went to live with the forest-dwelling rishi. And he never returned to the palace, even after his enlightenment. He never resumed his responsibilities as the leader of his country. He never resumed his responsibilities as father, husband in his family. And he lived as a mendicant, as a basically a monk who went out every day and asked for alms from people all his life until he died in his 80s. So all of this suggests, you know, passivity. Monks in a monastery are really not supposed to get up and listen to NPR and be actively involved in politics. In fact, you know, actually, sometimes monks get in trouble when they get involved in politics. You know, they back the wrong person or they're interfering. So, you know, basically, in Sri Lanka, the monks are involved in politics, and it's a big mistake. They probably do a lot of damage to Sri Lankan society, and also they disgrace the Dharma, because sometimes they're very nationalistic and chauvinistic, and it's not the Buddha's teaching at all. It would be better for them to just sit down on their cushion and be quiet, you know. But, you know, so generally speaking, we form an image of the Buddha's path as, you know, passive and so on and so on. And this is something that can affect the way we go through life, you know. It can affect the way we go through life, because sometimes we can assume that the Buddha's way is to basically avoid conflict, avoid, you know, challenges, you know, challenges, and avoid difficult situations, because, you know, basically we don't ask anything of life if we're Buddhists, you know. And so the idea that we should go through life asking for little, having little, not, you know, sidestepping trouble, and so on and so on. All of this is kind of a mental image of a Buddhist, you know. This is something I think it's very widespread. You know, as I mentioned yesterday, I've known people who basically have almost, you know, they're not alive anymore, but they had almost nothing. You know, in Japan, it was possible for a person to enter a monastery or a convent and give up the family name and become an anonymous person and live in a monastery your whole life and sleep on the tatami mat, one tatami mat, which is like 8x4, and have two items of clothing and your razor to shave your head, and a begging bowl, and a few other items, you know. And that's it, you know. And that is a kind of cultural ideal, you know. So you say, well, you know, I'm not a monk, but I should be very parsimonious. I shouldn't have, you know, things, and I should try to just be monk-like, you know. Now, that is a totally, in my opinion, monks and nuns are extraordinarily admirable people. And they do sometimes put us to shame in a good way, you know. So, you know, people in the modern world are so acquisitive and they're so hungry for things. And it deforms us very badly, you know. And we've got to have this and we've got to have that. And then you look at somebody like some of these monks I know and there's like a healthy sense of shame, you know. Because you say, oh my God, you know, this person's happy and he doesn't even have, you know, a shirt, you know. And then you realize, I don't really need a new shirt, you know. One of the things the Dalai Lama said was, they asked him about monkhood and he said, I love not having to worry about what clothes to wear, you know. I thought, and he wasn't being funny, he meant it, you know. It's absolutely clear what he has to wear every day. He doesn't have to worry about you know, getting the right color combination or being in style. You know, his robes have been in style for about 1,500 years. So basically Zen robes are about as old. The design is like an old design. It goes back to the Tang Dynasty, you know. When clothes looked this way, even regular people wore clothes like this. Basically, that simplicity is a good thing. And it does have a good social function. In Buddhist countries, the simplicity of the monk's life is a moral, is a check. You know, it's a check on the greed and selfishness that can take over people. And the Buddha really thought this through very carefully. He wanted the bhikkhus and bhikshunis to be like a voice of sanity in the society. He knew everybody wasn't going to become a monk and nun, but he wanted them to sort of be moral examples to everybody else so that, you know, people would just, they'd go, you know, I really don't need all of this. Look at that monk. He has two robes and a razor and a bowl. Surely I don't need a new car this year. You know, I could do without it, you know. So that's the idea. The Buddha's idea was that not everybody's going to pursue enlightenment, but there'll be enough people around who are awake so that they can kind of help the society clarify a little bit, you know. So this is all true. However, you know, it's important to realize that, there is such a thing as healthy energy. And let me put it another way. There is such a thing as this is going to sound a little shocking, but there is such a thing as healthy aggression, you know, or aggression that's not bad, you know. If you're, you know, there's a time to be forceful. There's a time to be forceful. There's a time to be assertive, you know. There's a time for assertiveness. And sometimes conflict happens, and you have to be willing to deal with it, you know. There is bad aggression. There's aggression that is destructive and selfish and horrible, and we see it every day. You know, I was born after World War II. But I was born around the time, so I didn't see the war that left millions of people dead, you know. I understand that in the Soviet Union, in Russia, every family in Russia lost at least one family member during the German invasion. So they think the Russians lost 20 million people. I might be wrong, but I believe that was the figure I read. I was astounded. That seems a little high right now, so don't quote me on that. But they lost a huge number of people in the war. In Mao's purge of China, they think that a lot of millions died in that, and then he created a famine that killed, I think it's like 30 million people. You know, so there's been a lot of killing as a result of terrible aggression. And so when we look at the violence all over our society and in our history, you know, we might recoil with horror. I missed World War II, but I saw Vietnam, which was, I thought, a totally wrong war. It was totally an imperialistic war. And we had no business in Vietnam, and we killed hundreds of thousands of people. We carpet bombed parts of Vietnam. Carpet bombs means you drop a bomb at like every half mile or every quarter mile. And we destroyed Cambodia. We destroyed their civilization. And then now we're in Iraq, and we've probably destroyed Iraq. You know, so this is such a dangerous thing to say, that there's a kind of healthy aggression. There's a kind of healthy forcefulness or assertiveness. You know, nevertheless, it's true. You know, it's true. There's a way of, you don't want to be a bully, and you don't want to go, you know, pushing people around. But it's important to be forceful and to have a kind of confidence in your actions, you know, and to be willing to be assertive. You know, this is very important. You know, when the Buddha was teaching, the Buddha taught that you shouldn't go looking for a fight. You know, you shouldn't. And in fact, he did teach nonviolence. One time, some monks were going through a crowd, and somebody hit a monk, and the monk hit him back. And the Buddha said, "You're out of the Sangha. You know, you're no longer. You can't be a bhikkhu anymore. You've stooped to violence." So the Buddha had a very high standard. You know. Nevertheless, you know, the Buddha himself didn't just go along to get along. You know. The Buddha was actually quite critical of his society. And he was very critical, for example, of Brahmanism, and he thought it was oppressive, and he thought that Brahmins were deceptive, and that they didn't have any special holiness, and that they were pretending to have authority they didn't have, and he even made jokes about them that were, you know, he said the Brahmins were like people who invite you to a lovely dinner and then at the end they hand you the check. And so he's really saying, look, they're having a lovely time at your expense. So the Buddha was not in favor of the caste system. And all people could enter the Sangha, you know, without distinction. And that got him in a lot of trouble, you know, actually. So basically, the Buddha made enemies. He made enemies. He had enemies. Even within his own family, he had a cousin named Devadatta. And when the Buddha organized the Sangha, he had a cousin who was involved in the Sangha, Devadatta, but eventually Devadatta wanted to take over the Sangha himself, and he wanted to rub out the Buddha. So he actually hatched an assassination scheme to kill the Buddha, and fortunately the Buddha didn't survive this. I mean, didn't get killed, and Devadatta's evil scheme did not come to pass. You know, it shows you the kind of environment the Buddha was in. He was challenging the authorities. He was, dealing with internal conflict in his community. He survived at least one assassination attempt. And he didn't just go, Devadatta, let's try to get along, you know, you can be the head, if you really want it, you can be the head of the community, you know, I'll step down, I don't want to make waves, you know. Even though the Buddha taught nonviolence, there is a kind of forcefulness, you know. In Zen, there's a lot of emphasis on being able to act directly with confidence, you know. I know that my teacher, when I used to do Dokusan with Genki Roshi, he always had his eyes closed, and so I learned to close my eyes. But when I started studying with Genki Roshi, I used to not look people in the eye, and that was because of my own upbringing. I had a really unfortunate upbringing in a lot of ways. And I had a hard time looking people in the eye. And after one sesshin, I walked up to Genki Roshi and I was looking him in the eye, and he said, you've really been in deep mushin. You know, you're looking me right in the eye. And he looked me right in the eye, and our eyes met, and I didn't feel this desire to like shield my eyes or turn away from him, you know. And he was trying to make he wasn't picking on me. He was trying to make a point. You know, you know the kind of energy you feel right now, the kind of confidence you feel, you need to take out of the Zendo, and you need to carry that through your life, you know. And I realized what he was trying to teach me, you know. A Zen person doesn't, the idea that a Zen person doesn't just, you know, come into a room and sort of try not to be noticed and try not to be, you know, a Zen person isn't, you know, doesn't enter a room like that. You know, a Zen person doesn't come in and think, notice me. But the point is, you walk into the room, you're direct, you're present, you're fully present, I'm here. And I'm going to act, you know, I'm going to act. And this is very important to be able to, this is like Zen off the cushion, you know, Zen off the cushion. It's not about being a bully, you know. We kind of think you're either a bully or you're basically going to be passive and meek. And those are not the only alternatives. There's a kind of forceful presentness that's very important, you know, very important. Some people are able to be like that. They're not bullies, but they're present. And they don't, if you push them, they'll push back, you know, politely, gently, but they're forceful. And this is very important, you know. In Zen temples, a lot of the training of Zen monks is to produce people who are able to be present unapologetically. I'm here. You know, I'm here on the scene. I'm going to act. You know, when I came to Rutgers, when I came to Rutgers, I had just finished graduate school. And I suddenly had to run this program that was enormous. It was enormous. There were 11,000 students in it. And at that time, it was smaller. There were probably about 8,000. And it was so intimidating to me. I wouldn't have taken the job, probably, if I had had a good alternative. But I needed a job, so I took this job at Rutgers, and I would go to these meetings where the people were like administrators and faculty, and basically I thought they were very aggressive. People in New Jersey are rather more aggressive than I was used to. I don't mean the ones who carry machine guns. I mean the regular ones, you know. I'm not talking about Goodfellas. I'm talking about ordinary New Jerseyans. You know, out in Seattle, in the West Coast, there's a kind of a style where, like, if you're jogging down the street and somebody's coming the other way, you'll just, even if you don't know them, you go, hi, and they go, hi. Okay, this is very West Coast. Hi. You know, I used to jog around Green Lake, and we'd jog around Green Lake, hey, hi. You don't even know the person, but it's friendly. This is a hippie culture. Everybody's friendly. And I love it, you know. And Seattle is the kind of place where, you know, if you're crossing a street and there's no crosswalk, the car will stop for you anyway, right? And it's like, please, you know, time is not important. Go across the street, you know. This is very Seattle, you know. People are, have a good day, you know. Okay. So New Jersey has actually gotten better. When I came out here, I was astounded, you know, because I would go running down in Johnson Park, and I'd go, hi, and people would look at me like, what the hell? Right? No, really, people would look at me like, what is your angle, man, you know? And people were not polite, you know? Somebody, if you try to walk, you're walking across the street and the car's coming, you know, get out of the way, you asshole, you know? And it's like, whoa, you know, where am I, you know? And I've actually seen people, you know, shaking their fist, and if nobody would, I mean, really, there's people like that in Seattle too, but it's not the culture. This is like the culture out here, you know, a very aggressive, you know. New Jersey is like an immigrant society, and generations of people who are a little bit like uprooted, you know. They're here, they don't necessarily feel connected to the people already here, and so there can be, you know, this layer after layer. People can be very sort of brusque, you know, and so there's a kind of impolite. You know, and I would go to these meetings, and people would be so, you know, I'm not going to do this. You must be out of your mind if I, you know. And there was a, oh my God, the engineering dean. There was an engineering dean who used to chew a big cigar. This is before there was no smoking. And he would take the cigar out of his mouth, and he was just so caustic. And I would go to these meetings, and I'd be sick to my stomach, you know. I just think I would literally be so nervous, you know, at these meetings. And I would, you know, I would just do my zazen and go in, and you know, I'd come out of these meetings, and I'd just be like, oh my God, you know, what have I done, you know. And I had a strong impulse to, you know, pack my bags and go back to Seattle, you know, where people are nice. But, you know, the Zen helped me, you know, because by nature I'm an introverted person, and I don't like to be forceful. I don't like to be aggressive. I still have to work on this quite a bit. But I realized, you know, sometimes you just have to, you know, you have to throw your weight around. You have to be decisive. And you have to say, you know, well, here's what I think, you know. And you don't have to say it in a mean way. You can just say, here's what I think. You know, here's what we're going to do. And you can put yourself out there and in a nice way, you know. I have seen other people do this very well, you know. Be forcefully present without being, I guess, aggressive, you know. Forcefully present without being belligerent, you know, without being, you know, combative, but forcefully present, decisive, and I realize I still have to work on this, you know, and it's especially tough in some contexts, but in my job I've learned how to be decisive. Now, you know, I work with people who go too far. You know, sometimes people can be too aggressive. You know, they're really sort of are making enemies, and that's not a good strategy. But there's a middle way where you're forceful and you're forceful but not belligerent. You know, so it's very important, you know, to realize that Buddhism is not about being a wimp. You know, it's not about being, you know, please drive your car over me and I'll take it. You know, when we think about nonviolence, we often misunderstand what it's about. You know, when Gandhi was engaged in his campaign, he didn't go to the British and say, look, you guys want to be in India? Okay, you can control India. You know, I don't want violence. I don't want any trouble. I just want us all to get along, right? He didn't say that. I mean, Gandhi said, you know, I want you guys out of India. And so did the other, at that time, 700 million people in India. We all want you to go. So Gandhi actually was involved in a conflict, a struggle with the British Empire. Now, he didn't allow people to fight with guns. And it was a miracle, right, actually. That there wasn't mass bloodshed and killing, you know. So you know, Gandhi was disappointed in some ways because there was inter-community violence. But you know, people didn't turn on the British and, you know, hang them and things like that. And so it was a huge success in a lot of ways. I'm always struck by the Dalai Lama, you know, because the Dalai Lama, you know, the Tibetans have been occupied by China for more than 50 years now. And the Chinese have humiliated and tortured the Tibetan people and tried to break their culture. And, you know, the Dalai Lama did not say to the Chinese, well, look, you guys want to control Tibet? Okay. Who am I to get in your way, right? I mean, he's fought a long campaign of non-violent, not passive, but non-violent resistance. I think it's so amazing that the Tibetan people haven't resorted to, like, terrorism. So, you know, you don't have Tibetans bombing Chinese railway stations and things like that. And I think that's a miracle, really. And I'm so proud of the Tibetan people for living out the Buddha's teachings so thoroughly, you know. But don't think that they aren't resisting. They're just not using bombs. The Dalai Lama and the Tibetan community is very forcefully involved every day in protecting their culture and protecting their society. They have a huge problem. There's 3 million Tibetans and there's a billion Han Chinese, but they're still engaged in the struggle. And the miracle is that they're still there. You know, their culture is still there. So this idea of being decisive and being present and being active is very, very important. And it's a big part of Zen. Acting from the energy that you encounter on the cushion. So, you know, the ideal thing is to sit down on the cushion, encounter, clarify body, mind, and heart, purify body, mind, and heart, still the mind, become calm and centered, and then encountering this energy, and then you get off the cushion, it's time to go to work, and you go out and you act from this energy, this sort of joyous energy, yeah? And sometimes you have to say, no, I can't agree with you, you know? And it's not wrong to say, no, I can't agree with you, or to say, you're mistaken, or to say, I won't do it, you know? Those are all, and it's also not wrong to be forceful. This confidence is really, really important. This confidence is really important. And I myself am still learning, you know. We encounter situations which are really very hard to deal with, very violent and aggressive. And maybe we have been badly treated, you know. We've had experiences that are, you know, very painful and difficult. And we can be in situations where we feel that things are out of control. You know, things are out of control. You know, and I'm sure you've had situations like this where things are out of control. You know, they're just spinning out of control. Things can get really bad, you know. And those are the most difficult situations, I think, when we feel that, you know, the social situation is degenerating and things are out of control. That's very painful, and especially if we've been done some kind of serious injury, you know, some kind of serious injury. That experience of being violated, of being attacked, or being injured is very, very difficult to deal with. It's extremely difficult. That's really very hard. When somebody we might have trusted violates our trust and does does violence to us, that's very shocking. And we can find that our confidence, our trust in the situation is completely destroyed. And then often what happens is we become passive and sort of start drifting, you know. We have a strong inclination to withdraw, you know, to withdraw. Now some people are, when they encounter any kind of a threat, they escalate the aggression. You know, I'm sure you've encountered people like this. When they're threatened, they become fiercely violent, you know. Now that would not be what we want, right? When people become fiercely aggressive and revengeful, that's a bad response, obviously. For people who are more sensitive and who are more, compassionate, when other people respond with violence and aggression, it can be shocking and demoralizing. And it can leave you feeling, totally shattered, you know. Especially if you're a sensitive person. I think it's very important to understand that this is hard to to appreciate. But, you know, the Zen, the teaching of the Mahayana is that everything, without exception, comes out of Buddha mind, out of what we call enlightened, this primal, all-forgiving, all-loving, compassionate energy. You know, that basically there's this radiant, compassionate energy that extends infinitely in all directions, and that we feel sometimes on the cushion, that we encounter sometimes on the cushion. And the Buddhist teaching is that everything, without exception, comes from this. Now, that's very difficult to appreciate sometimes, you know. Because when we encounter violence or destructiveness, especially if we're injured, it undermines our trust in everything. And we want to withdraw, or sometimes we even turn our aggression against ourselves. You know, self-hatred is a very common response when we've been violated. This is very common. Now, some people, you know, when they're attacked, just want to kill their opponent, right? They just want to kill. And they don't have any compunction. They don't have any hesitation. They would murder their attacker if they could, and they might even try. You know, people who are Buddhists don't usually respond that way, although there are Buddhist criminals, obviously. But the thing is, you know, most normal people who are walking this path don't want to be like that. So when they encounter aggression, when they encounter violence, you have to be careful not to turn that aggression, your aggression against yourself, to blame yourself or to hate yourself. You know, it's a very complicated psychological dynamic. But I think it's important when you're sitting on the cushion and you're struggling with all of this, you know, the Buddhist teaching is that everything comes out of that energy. And so even when things are spinning out of control and you want to shut down, it's important to realize that the possibilities are for a resolution, the possibilities for restoration, and the restoration of harmony, and so on, are there. That there's always something to work with in the situation. There's always a kind of positive undercurrent in the situation. And I'm not very good at this sometimes, but, you know, people can be skillful at trying to use those energies which seem so negative and redirect them towards a positive outcome. This is very difficult, you know, but it's important to have faith in the source, in the ground of all things is this radiant, boundless compassion. And when we look at violence and aggression, we're seeing distorted forms of that energy. And so there's a kind of natural harmony that is always potentially there. And so people who are skillful in their human relations don't respond with violence, but they're trying to take charge of the situation in a way that will allow these energies to emerge, these positive energies. So this is a little bit abstract, but what I'm saying is that there's always something you can work with in a situation, no matter how bad it is. There's always something you can work with. And so, you know, the violence and aggression requires creativity from you, and you need to be creative in the way you respond to injuries done to you, and you need to um, you need to return to a calm, stable mind and try to get in touch with that energy, and then you need to try to work with what you have, you know. And this is very difficult, especially when we feel threatened. But there's always the potential here for, there's always the potential, there's always something to work with in every situation. And it's very counterproductive to wish you weren't in your current situation. That's very, very counterproductive. Because basically you're in that situation. And I myself have been in situations where I've said, why, oh, why has this happened to me? I don't deserve this, you know. And wished I were somewhere else, but that's not a productive response. The energies that the you have to work with what you have, and you have to realize that it can be transformed into this positive outcome. Positive. You know, that people, the injuries we've done can be even our injuries, even the people, the things that have violated us, can be transformed into sources of strength. That's true. And it's even the things that have injured us can become sources of strength, you know. So, you know, sometimes things happen to us that are very painful and difficult, and they can seem like unmanageable, right? But this, in a way, there's always something there you can work with. There's always something there you can work with. And so bemoaning what has happened is not productive. You have to start being active, proactive, you know. Okay. Hokoji, by the way, is another word for Laiman Pang. Laiman Pang was a great Zen master who was a student of Basho, Matsu, the great teacher who really started Zen. And he had a number of different students. One of them was Laiman Pang. Laiman Pang never became ordained, but he was a great Zen teacher. He married a woman and they had two children, and the whole family became enlightened. So at this stage, Hokoji was leaving Yakusan. And Yakusan was basically a senior priest in Matsu's temple. And basically, Yakusan says to some of his students, please see Hokoji to the door of the gate of our temple. And as they're all going out, Hokoji pointed to the snowflakes and he said, beautiful snowflakes, one by one, they fall nowhere else. So he's saying, you know, the falling of the snow seems random, but actually there's an order unfolding in this moment. There's an order, like a mandala opening up in this moment, even though the falling of the flakes seems random. When you're in deep samadhi, every moment seems perfect. Every moment seems absolutely connected to the whole. See, and that's what Kohoji says. That's what Laiman Pang says. And one of the monks is jealous of Kohoji, is jealous, and sort of goes, oh yeah? He basically says, what a bunch of crap, you know. And Hokoji does something very interesting. He actually slaps the guy. Why did he slap him? Is it revenge? We would probably not, you know. In Zen we would say he's trying to help the other guy wake up. But Kohoji doesn't go, oh gee, you know, he hurt my feelings, or maybe I'm wrong, you know. He doesn't second guess himself, right? He has trust, deep trust in the unfolding of events, and he has learned to trust his true nature. And so when he's insulted by this guy, he actually just spontaneously slaps him. Now, I don't recommend this at all times, right? Unless you want to spend a night in jail. Right? But the point is, he takes charge of the situation. And we, because we know he's a deeply enlightened person, we assume he's trying to bring this to a creative outcome. He's trying to create a positive outcome. And so he slaps him. And the Zen student says, "Koji, you're so uncouth. What a crude response." And then Koji said, "If you are, if you're trapped in conventional thinking, you know, if you don't get out of your conventional rut, you know, your teacher's never going to let you finish your training. You know, you'll be in training till you're a geriatric case. You know, you've got to learn to be more open." And basically, the guy still is needling him. And he says, "Well, what about yourself? I suppose you've got it made in the shade. I guess you have the answers. You have all the answers." And Koji slaps him again. And he says, you look, but you don't see. You speak, but you are like a deaf mute." Now, notice this is really like a frank talk, right? He's not saying, "Come on, let's all get along. You know, okay, you don't like snowflakes? Okay, you know. And I must say, that's my nature. I kind of want to just placate everybody. I want to say, okay, that's fine." But he doesn't. He really wades right in, and he challenges the people there. And he forces people to sort of rethink their perspective. Secho says, "Don't waste your time talking. Hit him with a snowball, you know." So basically, there's a way, it's difficult, but off the cushion, it's important to be creative and active, not passive. Zen is not about being passive. It's about being active in a dynamic and creative way. And in order to have that kind of energy, you have to find it first on the cushion. You know, I've been so happy with the way the Sesshin has been going, because people have really been really sitting in a deep, sustained way, getting in touch with that life energy. And when we leave here at the end of the day and we drive home, we get up, might have to go to work tomorrow, you know, there are going to be challenges. And if you keep practicing, you will be able to use this groundedness to deal with life's challenges. It takes a lot of practice. But the point is that we're not about, this is not about being passive. You are in the world, and there's no escaping that. And you can't wish you were somewhere else. That's not a constructive response. And you can't wish you had some other life. You know, "I wish I had, why does this happen to me? If only I had another life." But that's pure escapism, right? So it's important and it's very important not to imagine ourselves as powerless in the face of events, right? Because we're not. Basically we have the energy of the universe behind us. And so, you know, being unafraid to be present, you know, Zen sitting is all about being present, not drifting into a fantasy world, but coming back to the moment. And actively present is another form of that practice. And we can take charge And there is a kind of order unfolding in things that we don't see as it's unfolding, but we have to sort of take on trust. The situation always contains the possibility for a better configuration. You know, it's like there's a mandala emerging here. Right now it looks like ruin and chaos, but it's emerging. And we have to be part of the mandala. We have to be part of the mandala. And so you have to take responsibility for the mandala, you know. Okay. So now, we're going to continue our wonderful practice, our beautiful practice on this extraordinary spring day. Sesshin is the most amazing thing in the world. Everybody's doing a magnificent job. Let's just use the rest of this very precious time to bathe in that beautiful, beautiful energy.